We have a special day today to called Awakening Justice and honoring the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Usually we begin with morning liturgy, a service. We sit meditation, zazen. We hear a discourse and chant together. And some of those elements will be present today. But first, just to begin with the presence, just quieting and calming ourselves, which is part of the tradition of Shakyamuni Buddha, of reaching deep inside ourselves to study our own heart and mind, to take care of our precious resource, most precious resource, the mind, so that we are able to enter this world and take care of each other, recognize each other, be noble together with all things. So we're going to begin with some meditation. Those of you at home, I can't see you right now. I just see a screen. But hopefully that'll open up a bit. But I have the residents here at the monastery, about 30 of us, and we're holding space. And we can cultivate this capacity for presence, which is most needed. And we can bring in whatever we are, our fears, our angers, our disappointments, our anxieties, and just be present to this situation. We don't have to fix ourselves, we don't have to fix each other. And when we choose to be more present, we're more present. So to touch and release and enter our own restlessness and discomforts, our joys. And we can keep expanding this. And so that's what we'll begin with, is this backward steps, bringing ourselves to the quiet pool that is deep within us. And when we first turn inward to see those winds that stir up waves on the surface and keep re-entering in the stillness and the silence to that quiet pool and just breathe for a while before we move. We have a full morning planned with different aspects. And transformation happens in breathing. Transformation happens in breathing. So we need to keep breathing and holding this space together where you are too. We're all connected right now in such a way. So we'll do this for about 10 minutes or so. I'll ring the bell and you can just turn inward in stillness. Settle yourselves, bring yourselves forward. Let's begin. Thank you. So we'll be punctuating the morning with periods of stillness so we can allow ourselves to be affected, touch our vulnerability, open. So I want to say, give a shout out to Tanya Bonner, Yama Fay, and Carmen Phelps, who helped put this morning together, and you'll hear from them shortly. So I wanted to say a little bit about Martin Luther King Jr. His birthday was January 15th, just passed, and he was born in 1912. 29. So if you can just imagine the United States at that time. Today he would be 92 years old if he was alive. And he was assassinated on April 6, 1968, at the age of 39. So all of his sermons and his connection to us was in his, from age 19 to age 39. So I don't know how many of you out there are in your 30s, but just to feel that, how old he was and how much he accomplished and offered. And when he was assassinated, literally words of love were spilling from his mouth. So we're honoring his legacy. And a legacy is something transmitted or received from an ancestor. So what are we being transmitted? What have we received? In 1948, when he was 15 years old, he wrote, "My call to ministry came about this summer of 1944 when I felt an inescapable urge to serve society. In short, I felt a sense of responsibility which I could not escape." We're talking about a 15-year-old young man having this bodhisattvic calling, this urge that he heard, that he needed to respond to, hearing the cries of the world. In his short 15 years of being here in that particular form, this vow, bodhisattva vow, to offer liberation, to care for others, freedom. Freedom from suffering. Kind of extraordinary. So we call this awakening to justice. So what is awakening? What are we awakening to? What is justice? In your words, in your body, in your mind. You know, when we take this backward step, we hear much of the language we hear in the news going on within our own minds, don't we? How have we gone after our own capital? How are we rioting in our own veins and sinuses, in our own bloodstream? How are we having bitter internal showdowns with our family and friends in our mind as we quiet down and take a look? How are we creating peace? How are we creating wars? Everything we see out there, we can see inside ourselves to heal, to take care of. So Buddha and other bodhisattvas like Martin Luther King tell us to stop our own wars within first as we're working with others. Martin Luther King, in his words, said, "We are all tied together in a single garment of destiny, an inescapable network of mutuality. I can never be what I ought to be until you are allowed to be what you ought to be." When I was talking to Tanya, she said, "Yeah, it's like an orchestra. Like we need every single instrument to have its tune, to play in harmony, to join together." So a legacy is to give back, repay. How do we do this? So Martin Luther King said, "I have a dream." Yeah, indeed. So can we dream this together? So I'd like to bring on Tanya to say good morning.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you. The journey that led us here today to our second annual MLK event actually began back in 2019. One of the wonderful changes the MRO has made towards the goal of greater diversity was getting more diverse input on MRO programming. And I noticed that we had not held any events or anything acknowledging MLK Day. And I wanted that to change. So, because over the years, you know, I had to go to other centers, you know, to such as New York Insight Meditation to be able to honor MLK and do the reflective work that they ask of us. So it was a very hard time to always feel like I had to travel outside of my spiritual home to be able to reflect on and acknowledge the work of Martin Luther King, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. So we began planning our first MLK event, which was held last January. Some of you may have joined us. The event was held simultaneously with the Fire Lotus Temple in Brooklyn and at the Zen Mountain Monastery. It was a wonderful day. We even had people in the Brooklyn Center, we had people just come in from the surrounding community, which was a beautiful thing that we don't always see, that doesn't always happen. They and what we were doing called to them. As we all know, that's a very diverse community. And as they say, if you build it, they will come. And so we built it and people came and it was beautiful. This year we wanted to, I personally and everyone else who was involved in this planning wanted to make an ask of you this year to dig deeper in your practice around inequity and injustice, because yes, that is a practice too. So we wanted you to dig deeper. And so this year we held a panel of Black, some of you probably joined us on Thursday, we held a panel of Black Sangha members. And we were joined by Dr. Ayo Pamela Yetunde, who's the co-editor of the book, Black and Buddhist, for a brave conversation on our experiences as Buddhists and as human beings. And today we will ask you to dig deeper still. We will ask you, as we take you on this journey, to dig deeper about injustice and awakening to that injustice. So thank you for joining us today. This is a beautiful sight to see all of you, as this is a first step, and it shows that you recognize that our fates are tied together. Thank you.
So now Kaishu will begin with a quote from Martin Luther King to share with us. Thanks, Kaishu.
First, I must confess that over the past few years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate who was more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly says, I agree with you in the goal that you seek, but I cannot agree with your methods of direct action, who paternalistically believes that he can set the timetable for another man's freedom, who lives by a mythical concept of time, and who constantly advises the Negro to wait for a more convenient season. Shallow understanding from people of goodwill is far more frustrating than absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will. Lukewarm acceptance is much more bewildering than outright rejection.
Just feel where that lands in you. Yama will be joining us next to take us on her journey
Thank you, Logan. And thank you, everyone, for being here today. We will now take you on an exploration journey in my neighborhood, a place that has influenced a new life of advocacy in me. We'll be taking a walk in Brownsville, Brooklyn, a Black community, looking at the disparities the community is facing. We will go on a drive around Eastern Parkway and Grand Army Plaza, two affluent neighborhoods in Brooklyn, all of them within a 5 mile radius. And we will end at the Fire Lotus Temple, Zen Center of New York City.
So at this time, as we're sitting for a bit, you can offer reflections in the chat room about this video and just what you're left with inside. We'll take a few moments to do that. Tanya, if you'd like to read some of those, I can't see them from my seat.
Okay. Yes. From what I'm seeing, we're seeing someone starting to come in. Someone said, thank you for putting the video together and offering it to us. Great to see the awareness of places in NYC. Sharon said, feeling the sadness and struggle. Iris McGrath said, a powerful portrayal of injustice. Mark Cantor said, the fact of food deserts is staggering. And Jifu said, very powerful visuals of disparity and injustice. Maureen said, food desert contrasted with a cornucopia of fresh foods, emblematic of unequal distribution of common goods. Kestrel Mills said, feeling sadness and anger at the loss of Black-owned small businesses and that the neighborhood is a food desert. And Tinfu said, tears and a sense of failure from our part. Sagan said, it's way too easy to turn away and pretend that we're doing fine, doing a good job, but obviously that's not true. And Charsley Tiwa Land said, as affluence moves back to city centers, when will gentrification reach Brownsville? And Nicole said, feeling sad, tears flowing. Thank you for this. Very moving and important. Fusho said, thank you, Yama and team. I want fresh fruit, gluten-free, and live trees for everyone. Yes, we do. And Tosho said, such an extraordinary symbiosis. Kaishu's MLK reading. And Amy said, this is Tom, reminded that my practice at Sin Center of New York City in Borm Hill for years was healthy, safe, vibrant every time because it was built on the lack in other neighborhoods and injustice. Yes. Yes. David said, I want to listen more. Clyde said, unjust distribution of resources. And Barbara, thank you for the beautiful, poignant, and sad images. I will think of this each time I am at my local farmer's market. How can we change this? Yes, how can we change this? Brian said, the video shows that the sun shines everywhere. Hmm. Alex said, this is not new, old and deep in our country. No, it's not. Thank you for that. Matt said, I was particularly moved by the shot of memorial made for the men murdered by the police. That's everywhere in Brownsville. Kenshu said, does the food desert issue provide a possible outreach for Fire Lotus to the community? That's a really good question. Kyodu said, do we need to have a no loitering sign on the main door? Lisette said, the memorial to the child whose life was taken makes me so sad. Sadly, it's everywhere in Black and brown communities in our city. Kestrel said, angry that Black-owned small businesses were left to fail by giant corporations with mostly white CEOs and execs are bailed out by the government. And Siren, and if I'm mispronouncing your name, please forgive me. Sorry, screen changed here. Siren said, I had to look up sacrifice zone. so sad that along with the lack of resources, people with so little are living in a toxic area. And that's what we have so far. Did we, Dojaku said, I wonder what can be done to help support and promote Black-owned businesses both now and after COVID has passed. It will be very easy for larger corporations to take over and for them to be lost entirely. Mark said this discrepancy is not just seen in big cities, but in many areas, even in small towns. It is important to know that you can work to make a difference just where you live. Yes, Mark, we can make a difference just where we live, right outside the temple doors. Do we want to take any direct questions from the people in the Zendo?
Yeah, that comes across really powerfully, very strong, and hits extremely close to home. And yes, I agree with the comment that it's very potent following Dr. King's remarks that were given, you know, more than 40 years ago. It's a lot to take in and feel my own complicity. And I appreciate the invitation to do that because I see that that is exactly the work that I need to do. Thank you.
So Shugen Roshi isn't here physically, but he's offering some Dharma words for us. If you're new, we always like to say these talks are dark to the mind, but radiant to the heart. And to open up to listening, to just listening, just hearing. So we're glad that he can be with us in this way. He's followed this project, this what we've been working on all along. We've shared with him as well. So thank you for coming in. And after that, we'll take a short break. So you can step away from your computer for a few minutes to get a drink, use the restroom, and come back.
Thank you for being here today. As we both celebrate the person and the love and the efforts and work of Dr. Martin Luther King, and bring those, all of that to life here, today in this place, within this gathering. Dr. King said, a riot is the language of the unheard. We might think about all the many languages, the different ways of expressing the calls that come from the unheard, those whose voices are not heard by those who need to hear them. They can come out as anger and rage, as sadness and confusion, but also as resilience and commitment, as spiritual power and compassion. In the Metta-sutta, the Buddha said that we might bring forth a deep, deep, heartfelt wish that in gladness and in safety may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, forsaking none, we will forsake none of them. The great or the mighty, the medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and those yet to be born, those heard and those not heard. And the Buddha realized that selfless compassion, great compassion, must include every being, every human being, every size and shape, every situation, every time and place, and every other being, animate and inanimate. It must include every being. And that has to include hearing the cries of Avalokiteshvara, the great bodhisattva of compassion, who hears the cries of the world. And that compassion has to be the hearing of those cries, those calls, and we respond, because these have to go together. We can't just hear the calls and not respond. And in order to do that, we have to deal with the suffering, not just in others, but in our own mind, in our own hearts. To alleviate others' suffering means we have to be prepared to be healed by others. We create delusion together. We awaken together. We fall down together. We rise up together. In the Lotus Sutra, there's a chapter on Kanon Bodhisattva, the perceiver of the cries of the world. And a student asks the Buddha, how does Kanon come and go in this world of suffering? How does she teach the Dharma to alleviate the pain and suffering of others? What kinds of skillful means does she employ? How does she appear? How does she respond? And the Buddha says, if there are living beings who need someone in the body of a Buddha to be relieved of suffering, then Kanon manifests in a Buddha body and teaches the Dharma through that body. If they need a person of wealth or a person who is poor, then she becomes that person, rich or poor. If they need a monastic, if they need a lay student, then she appears in that body. If they need someone who's young, a child, if they need an elderly person, then she appears in that form. In other ways, she appears in whatever way she manifests, however will serve others. That's her selflessness. And the Buddha said, and importantly, she bestows fearlessness on those who are in fearful, pressing, or difficult circumstances. This is why Kanon is called the one who gives fearlessness. Reflect on that, the one who gives fearlessness. How do we do that? Kanon Bodhisattva is, as we understand it in Buddhism, as we practice it in Buddhism, as we realize it within Buddha Dharma, Kanon is present in each and every one of us. That's our essential nature. It's our Buddha nature, which means she is present in every moment. That anyone, any person, in any place, in any circumstance, offers help to another, expresses their compassion, shows loving kindness, helps to reduce someone else's suffering or pain, helps to bring something good and beneficial into another person's life. No matter how small, no matter how simple, that's the manifestation of Kanon Bodhisattva. And they do this knowing that the one they serve, the person we face, is a Buddha. They are complete. They are perfect in their nature. They are dignified in their being. They are deserving of happiness and peace. They are deserving of compassion. Kanon Bodhisattva has no illusion that she or he or whoever they might be is in any way different than whoever they may be facing, whoever they may be trying to serve. That's their selflessness. And they practice selflessness. We practice selflessness. This is what our practice is, letting go of self-clinging, letting go of self-centeredness in our thoughts, in our speech, in our actions. And then within that selflessness, when we help someone, we help everyone. By alleviating the suffering of one person, we alleviate everyone's suffering. In the deepest sense, this is why compassion is the most spiritual of all human efforts, qualities, expressions. It has an outer expression, but at its core, it takes us to the very basis of our being in this world. And Kanon Bodhisattva doesn't respond to others out of a sense of obligation. She's not following a rule. She doesn't do it out of guilt or shame. She doesn't do it for reward or recognition. She does it because that's her nature. That's our nature, is to serve, to give, to be a benefit, to be compassionate, offering loving kindness. That's why loving kindness. That's why hatred and anger is always painful. That's why it's always destructive. That's why it always takes delusion to sustain it, because it is in deep conflict with our essential nature. So when we are out of our self-centeredness, out of suffering, are filled with anger, hatred, when others are filled with anger and hatred and act out of that, yes, they are suffering. But the suffering at the core, regardless of how we might think about it or rationalize it, is because we are in that moment not only not in accord with our own essential self, but we're also not in accord with others' essential selves and with the basic nature of the world. And so, of course, that's going to be painful. Of course, that's going to be like a great rift. In that sense, there is no personal freedom, no personal liberation, no separate safety, no individual delusion or enlightenment. That's how intimately we are bound together. So how does Kenon meet the one who hates, the one who is not crying out for help, who doesn't yet recognize how they project their own imprisoned mind onto the lives of others? Isn't that what we've been seeing in vivid display for hundreds of years? And most immediately, in the last weeks, in the last years, people's imprisoned minds being projected onto the lives of others. So how does Kenon meet someone who is not asking for help, who is not in their awareness crying out for help? The same. Compassion in Buddhism is likened to rain. It falls equally everywhere. And while each of us has one basic nature, we call it Buddha nature, awakened nature, we manifest it differently, unequally, because our world, our society, our history, our institutions, and our minds through all of those systems have created inequalities in our mind and between us. They don't exist by themselves. They're born from our not understanding things as they are. They're born from our greed, our anger, our profound delusion. But not being real, self-existing, doesn't mean that they don't have real consequences. Of course they do. And so in bringing compassion to all beings, we recognize that different beings need different forms of compassion. And so in the 10 values that came out of our Beyond Fear of Differences work, we speak of equity. That to create just outcomes, good outcomes, good lives, good minds, open hearts, we recognize that different treatment, including reparations, is sometimes required because of historical oppression and our varying positions in contemporary society. And so as I speak and I use the pronoun we, I recognize that I am positioned within a white body, a male body, and that that has come with enormous entitlements, unasked for, but I have benefited. And that when I say we, that in a certain way, I try to use that in a way that speaks of our universal nature. And I also try to be careful not to use that in a way that assumes anything about you, that understands that although we have one basic nature, we do in fact live in different worlds. And isn't that exactly what we're trying to address and really clarify and free ourselves of through our practice? And so may we ceaselessly work towards building a greater trust between ourselves and between our groups of identification. And this building of trust is there's a greater responsibility in dominant groups. Groups of white people, groups of men, those in leadership, those who have greater power. There's a greater responsibility that those of us in those groups work hard to earn the trust of those who have been hurt beyond our imagination for hundreds of years. That's our responsibility, our obligation, not just to others, but to ourselves as well. That we be trustworthy to ourselves as well as others. And so in the 10 values, we speak of trust as cultivating and earning a confidence together between ourselves that we are working toward our mutual well-being and liberation. Imagine a group of people, a community, a nation who shared in that endeavor, that we are working toward our mutual well-being and liberation. We all know, and every religion knows, that if we were to put that, not just in thought, but in our deeds as our fundamental, important commitment, that not only could we do that, but that the world would be an extremely different place. May we hold each other as we build trust between ourselves and be held in accountability, so that we can ensure that our aspirations and our commitments to free ourselves of suffering that we would then inflict on others, and that we do all that we can to diminish, alleviate the pain and the sorrow of others. Ensure that our aspirations and commitments to this are being manifested in what we do. Making vows is extremely important. Iterating those vows every day is extremely important, but it's not enough. To visualize well-being in the four immeasurables is a very powerful practice, but it alone is not sufficient. We have to actually be doing this in our lives in a way that becomes manifest, that is experienced, perceived by others. And importantly, we need to do this honestly and with compassion and loving kindness. Sometimes when we hold others or we ourselves are held accountable, it's painful because it challenges us to face aspects of ourselves that we would rather not acknowledge. We don't want to acknowledge that we harbor. As a white person, I don't want to acknowledge that I harbor racist views, that I have acted out of those views and hurt people that I care about, that I love, as well as strangers, that have been part of systems that have done the same on a large scale. I don't want to acknowledge that. But if I don't, then I ensure that I will continue to perpetuate that kind of harm. And that is my commitment, is to cease, to go a different way. And so accountability in the 10 values is recognizing that the Sangha, which includes teachers, seniors, monastics, board members, students, committees, practitioners, are mutually responsible for upholding these very values and communicating with each other. We have to do this together. And so may we develop our skills, our understanding, our capacities. May our capacity become large, particularly for those of us who in particular need to do this work of undoing racism. May we stretch ourselves and become large in our capacity to face the suffering within ourselves and others. Like the hands and eyes of Kenon, you know, you've seen those images where she has a hundred of arms and hands spreading out, radiating out. And in each hand is an implement, something that she uses, right? The question to the Buddha was, what is the skillful means that is used, that Kenon uses to alleviate suffering? And so we have to develop those skillful means. We have to develop it through our understanding and capacities and by working on it. And so the value of the whole person framework, that in our study, Liberation of the Self, we recognize that because our social identities are not experienced in isolation, we can't examine them in isolation. We have to look at ourselves as a complex, as an integrated whole being, and not just whole within our body and mind, but whole within our world, our society, our community. All of the ways in which we have projected out into the world and been projected upon in turn, all of those experiences that have helped to form our sense of both who we are as a self, as an identity, and what the world is. And to examine all the ways in which those have been formed falsely. Those have been formed within greed, anger, and delusion to foster various forms of oppression, denial, rejection, to exclude. And so may we dismantle, may we realize as empty of in any inherent quality what we call racism. What Isabella Wilkerson has rightly, I think, and powerfully framed as caste. May we dismantle this in every and any way we can. And ultimately by realizing how profoundly constructed it is, not just historically, not just through institutions, but in our mind, how we give it solidity. May we be the one who gives fearlessness. What a wonderful aspiration. May I be one who gives fearlessness to the world. How do I do that? Well, I have to confront my lack of fearlessness, my lack of courage. So that means I have to work with my own fear, my own trepidation, my own hesitation, particularly in moments when they arise, particularly moments when I feel overwhelmed. And so there is the value of courage, which we describe as the ability to step forward, to be vulnerable, to tolerate discomfort, and hold space for new ideas. That's our Buddha mind. It's powerful in its boundlessness. When we don't put up walls in the mind, there's nothing that we can't allow in. And that allows us to become generous, to really bring forth our natural generosity, to be magnanimous, to be abundant in our heart. And then to let that come out in our words, our thoughts, our actions. The Buddha once said, if human beings could only see things as he did, then he was confident that we would all dedicate our lives to giving. If we could only see the world as he did from this deeply enlightened view, then we would see profoundly how essential giving is and how natural it is. And it would not be such an effort. And so the value of generosity, which we speak of as the willingness to embrace all of our experiences within the Sangha, within the world, with openness and appreciation. And the willingness to give and take in feedback, to be held accountable on the impact of our actions as an essential part of our Dharma training. How else can we study the self? We're too accustomed to ourselves. We've been living with ourselves our whole lives. We've been listening to our voice inside of our mind our whole lives. It's very hard to hear ourselves clearly the way other people do. Our facial expressions, our energy, we're so inside of it. It's hard to have that kind of clarity. It comes more and more with practice. That's part of what we're developing. That's part of our skill. But we need the help of others. That's where others are like mirrors reflecting back. And then we need to meet that with in generosity, that we are open in receiving that. Fearlessness in the Bodhisattva path is spoken of as understanding that this path is long. I don't expect to see the end of racism in my life. I do expect to commit my life to ending racism. And to hold those together, they are not in conflict. So fearlessness means to recognize that the path is long and to free ourselves from the notion, the dualistic notion, that I am going to fix this. Now I am free to apply myself to liberating racism in every way possible. Fearlessness is to recognize that the challenges we meet and will meet are real and many, and that the suffering is great. And in that, we see and are humbled, naturally humbled, by the depth to which we have each been socialized and trained to see ourselves and each other unequally. Within our ideas and beliefs, our emotions that arise, the assumptions we make, our projections, this is what we must see and relinquish free. Huen Lung, the great ancestor, said, free the thoughts in your mind. Do not imprison them. Those biased, false ideas, beliefs, and emotions, and so on, we need to free ourselves of them, and then they are free. And in that, they become transformed. And so humility, the recognition of the depth of our own conditioning and the vastness of the path. And again, to recognize that for each of us, these values and how we hear these teachings are going to be different. There's a universal quality, and then there are ways in which they're going to be heard, felt, experienced, and acted upon differently by each of us, based on the position we have in this body, within this society. And that's our work, is to each take it in and sort of understand that within ourselves, apply it within ourselves. In studying the self, we have to study each other. They're not separate. And so we have to understand how culture and identity and language histories have all been inculcated within our fabric of being, and used in a way that is used to separate us from each other, to create a sense that we are absolute beings, autonomous, independent, and so to validate or justify oppression, to justify superior and inferior, high and low. In other words, we must end the hundreds of years of institutionalized segregation between us, within us, which helps to perpetuate our delusions about race as an inherent fact. And so the value of the whole person framework in our study and liberation of the self, we recognize that because our social identities are not experienced in isolation, we can't examine them in isolation. And this brings us to an authentic experience, I believe, of respect, a profound respect and appreciation and love for each other and for every being. Not in spite of our perceived differences. It's not that we have somehow overcome them, but in understanding them as they truly are. Now we can rejoice, really. We can celebrate, we can be joyful in those differences. The Metta Sutta says, being freed from hatred and ill will, whether we are standing, walking, seated, or lying down, freed from this, we can now live within what the Metta Sutta called the sublime abiding, the abiding of a Buddha, of an awakened being, open, courageous, resilient, clear-seeing, no longer holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, and this means you and me and every person, may now have a clarity of vision. And this brings us into a state of reverence. Reverence is a deep respect for each other's humanity and how we appear in the world, what we call identities, and the transformative power of the Buddha Dharma, this profound Dharma. To have reverence for each other. And so we can see how each of these values, all of these teachings are this tremendous medicine for the ills that we see running wild in our world. May all beings be at ease, the Metta Sutta says, let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. That's our practice. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. And when we find ourselves wishing harm, we recognize that. We bring our practice to it. We bring mindfulness to it. We understand it. We understand that anger arises. We understand that rage rises. And it's not arising independently. It's arising in mutual relatedness with things that are happening. It's a message to us, in a sense. Practice is our commitment to how do we meet that with those 10,000 hands and eyes. Even as a mother protects her life, with her life, her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart, should we cherish all beings. And so to be truthful, to be true, to have our eyes and hearts open, when we see more and more clearly, really is the only viable path. There is no other viable path. And that's why for every life that is taken through the violence of oppression, countless lives are shattered, countless deaths of the spirit and soul. Everyone is affected. It's easy to have anger. It's easy to hate. It's easy to bring that forth in other people. That's what every demagogue knows. That doesn't take any skill at all. Compassion, loving kindness, love is the greatest spiritual challenge and practice for us as human beings. It's also our most natural and essential nature. So why should it be so difficult? In a sense, because we have been trained to make it difficult. But we can reclaim that which is our true being, our true nature. Compassion, loving kindness, selfless love. And this is the love that demands that we go into the deepest parts of our mind and our heart and our body and our lives. That we deeply examine our views, our understanding, that we bring forth great aspirations, all so that we can manifest as the great Bodhisattva. This is my wish. This is what I bring into my vows every morning. And when I bring those vows to mind, I hold in my mind people, you, faces, the Sangha. I also bring to mind people in the world that I've never met that are suffering. And I also bring to mind people that I've never met who are creating that suffering. And I wish for them, I extend to them well-being, safety, gladness, freedom from suffering, loving kindness, equanimity. And I do that every day, and then I devote my life and my day to doing what I can in as many ways as possible through my place and situation and field of influence to bring forth that vow, that commitment as a living reality. And that's what I hope all of us are doing from our own places, using our own strengths, using our own situations, our own fields of influence. If we're all working together, that's a good thing. That's a good way to meet the madness, the insanity of the world that would cause us to despair, but we cannot. in a sense, we cannot afford to indulge in that. And so we really do need each other more than we know, I think. I can honestly say that all of my years, these decades in practice and training, have just continually opened up to me more and more how profoundly and in ways I never imagined I need you. So thank you for being here today and giving yourself to your life, our lives, Buddha Dharma. Please be well.
So please continue to sit with these words resonating through you, or take a moment to use the restroom. And we'll come back in just a few moments. And Carmen will begin. Thank you. See you in a few minutes, about a 5-minute break.
All right, everyone, I think we're going to get ready. In 2020, data showed us that police continue to kill Black men and women at disproportionate rates, even after the death of George Floyd sparked international protests against racism and police brutality. Today, in this space, we will read the names of 159 Black people who lost their lives as a result of police violence. These deaths occurred in the United States during the first 8 months of 2020. The names you're about to hear were compiled using databases from Mapping Police Violence, The Washington Post, and CBS News. With that being said, we ask that as you listen, please remember that this is not just data or a list. From January 2020 to August 2020, police killed at least one Black man or Black woman every week. These are their names.
Jamari Dewan
Tabor. Tyree Davis. Brandon Deontay Roberts. Kwame Jones. Maka Lee. Claude Washington Thane III. Earl Facey. Henry Isaacs Jones. Ryan Sims. Keenan McCain.
Albert Lee Hughes. Renard Antonio Daniels. Mubarak Soliman. Samuel David Mallard. Calvin White. Gamal Antonio Brown. Darius J. Tarver. Reginald Leon Boston, Jr. Michael J. Rivera. Andrew J. Smyrna.
DeAndre Lee Seabro Patterson. Marquise Golden. Joshua James Brown. Dovian Samaj Perkins. William Howard Green, Jr. Jacqueline O'Neill Light. Keith Dutry Collins. Abdirahman Salad. Leonard Charles Parker Jr. Ronel Muzan.
Alvin Cole. Dominic Mark Dominic Neal. Dominique Antoine Anderson. Jeremy Grayson. Bobby Joe Gibbs. Kevin Aldoff. Joseph C. Jewell III. Matthew Felix. Kenneth Leniel Sashington. Justin Lee Stackhouse. Desmond Hayes. Anthony Taylor.
March.
Manuel Ellis. Devin Austin Twilley. Elijah Jamal Brewer. Tyler M. Jones. Barry Gideous. Zachary Anderson Jr. Donnie Sanders. Brianna Taylor. Daryl William Mobley Sr. Darwin Barnell Foy.
William Dion Tolbert Simpkins, killed March 17th in Atlanta, Georgia, age 39. LeBaron Ballard, killed March 18th in Abilene, Texas, age 28 years old. Harold Spencer, killed March 19th, Iota, Louisiana, 61 years old. Michael Johnson, killed March 20th, Tallahassee, Florida, age 31. Alvin Lamont Baum II, killed March 20th in Virginia Beach, Virginia, 23 years old. Kamal Kobe Edwards, 18 years old, killed on March 21st in Cuthbert, Georgia. Daniel Prude, 41, killed by a Rochester, New York policeman on March 23rd. Terrell Fincher, killed March 27th, Newburgh, New York, age 26. Itoni T. Tazimore, killed March 30th, Baltimore, Maryland, age 38.
Nathan R. Hodge, Tommy Dell McLaughlin, Jr., Idris Abdus Salam, Dwayne Curtis Lafond, Joshua DeAndre Ruffin, Desmond Franklin, Kenesha Nicole Fuller, Jonathan Lee Adams, Goldie Bellinger, Jasmine Washington.
Derek L. Powell, Stephen DeMarco Taylor, Joel Acevedo, Virgil Thorpe, Chase Rosa, Joshua Johnson, Elmer L. Mack, Kelvin D. Shaw, Jonas Joseph, Sean Lee Fur, Malcolm Xavier Ray Williams,
May, Drayston Reed, 21, Brent DeAndrew Martin, William Lamont DeBose, also 21, Saeed Jaquin, 26, Demontre Bruner, Jayshon Landy Hodge, Kavon Webb, Finan H. Berhey, Mikhail Rose, Adrian Medeiros.
Yasin Mohammed. David Tylek Atkinson. Richard Scales. Randy Rosell Lewis, Robert Johnson Jr., Terry J. Caver, Toby LaRon Wiggins, William Johnson Jr., Willie Lee Quarles Sr., Maurice F. Gordon.
Dion Johnson, George Floyd, Tony McDade, Modesto Reyes, Reuben Smith III, Jarvis Sullivan, Terrell Mitchell, Momadou Lehman Cisse, Derek Thompson, David McAtee.
June.
Malik Taquan Graves, Kamal Flowers, Louis Ruffin Jr., Philip Jackson, Michael Thomas, Richard Brooks, Kane Van Pelt, Donald Ward, Brandon Gardner, Teron Jamal Boone.
Skylar Young, Robert Delon Harris, Rashid Matthew Mormon, Aloysius LaRue Keaton, Kai Johnson, Kavan Ruffin, William Wade Burgess III, Joseph W. Denton, Malik Canty, Errol Johnson.
July.
Richard Lewis Price, Hakeem Littleton, Cannabis Dewan Glass, Vincent DeMario Truitt, Antoine Baris, Malcolm Como, Darius Washington, Vincent Harris, Jeremy Southern, David Earl Brooks.
August.
Winston Joseph Latour III, Darren Walker, Ashton Broussard, Amir Johnson, Julian Edward Roosevelt Lewis. Salathus Melvin. Jonathan Jefferson. Raphael Javon Minifield. Kendrell Antron Watkins.
Anthony McLean. Adrian Jason Roberts. Hassani Best. Trayford Pellerin. Damian Lamar Daniels. Julius Pei Kei. Michael Anthony Harris. Dijon Kizzy. October. These names are yet unheard. November. These names are yet unheard. December. These names are yet unheard.
For all those forgotten, unseen, and unsung, we remember, sing, and see you now.
Moreover, I am cognizant of the interrelatedness of all communities and states. I cannot sit idly by in Atlanta and not be concerned about what happens in Birmingham. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. Never again can we afford to live with a narrow, provincial, outside agitator idea. Anyone who lives inside the United States can never be considered an outsider anywhere within its bounds.
Thank you all for being here today. We're going to close with the four immeasurables. I want to thank again those Carmen, Tanya, and Yama who came forward to lead this and set all this up, and the many other hands and eyes who contributed along the way. And reclaiming our true nature, as Shugan Roshi spoke, is the best way to express and repay our debt of gratitude. And may we do that all together. Be brave alone, to be brave together. So thank you for being here, and we're going to chant the four immeasurables led by Kaishu, and then we're going to sit another period or two here in the Zendo, which you're welcome to join us for, just to let all this settle in. Thank you very much. I love you all, Sangha. I love that you're here. Thank you.
May all beings be free from suffering and the root of suffering. May all beings know happiness and the root of happiness. May all beings live in sympathetic joy, rejoicing in the happiness of others. May all beings live in equanimity, free from passion, aggression, and delusion. May all beings be free from suffering and the root of suffering. May all beings know happiness and the root of happiness. May all beings live in sympathetic joy, rejoicing in the happiness of others. May all beings live in equanimity, free from passion, aggression, and delusion. May all beings be free from suffering and the root of suffering. May all beings know happiness and the root of happiness. May all beings live in sympathetic joy, rejoicing in the happiness of others. May all beings live in equanimity, free from passion, aggression, and delusion.